wiggity 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 boom 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 boom. You're listening to Frank Crattle. My name is Zephyr Thrall. You're listening at 89.5 FM KPOO here in San Francisco. You're also listening to Art Radio WPS1 at WPS1.org, PS1 Contemporary Art Center, a MoMA affiliate. You might also be listening at San Francisco Arts Commission Gallery. The website for that is www.sfacgallery.org. You might also be listening at frankprattle.com. God bless. It is my special privilege today to have two amazing guests with me. Adam Kleinman, Associate Curator of the Lower Manhattan Cultural Council. Hi, Adam.
Hi.
And Sam Gould, an artist and activist in Portland, Oregon, the chief, if you will, of Red 76.
Hi, Zephyr.
Maybe we can just start out, you guys give your websites and tell us a little bit about who you are and what the hell you do.
Sure. My name's Sam. I live in Portland, Oregon. I'm here in San Francisco because you asked me to be, which is nice. And I'm involved with this collaborative called Red 76, which creates varied projects that are under the rubric of art, yet some people tend to wonder why. They tend to involve aspects of education, at times activism, of a very nebulous sort. Investigations into history and group involvement, things like that.
Sounds good.
As well, a lot of kind of dealing with ideas of dissemination and printmaking, media, things along those lines.
Adam, yourself?
My name's Adam. For my day job, I work at a place called the Lower Manhattan Cultural Council, which is a sort of arts advocacy institution in Lower Manhattan that tends to focus on the area below 14th Street, but even more principally in what's called the Financial District. The institution itself it's sort of a multi-headed hydra. It has a residency program, which you should look into if you're interested in coming to New York for 9 months. Also, various grant-based projects, both space and money, and I'm part of a department called Cultural Programming, which does basically generally site-specific or outside public projects, usually unique commissions.
Sounds good. And the website for that is?
www.lmcc.net.
And Sam, Red 76's website for those listening?
It's www.kink.com.
I've been to that one.
No, sorry, it's red76.com, R-E-D-7-6.com.
Ah, I see.
Sorry, that was a neighborhood reference.
Yes. Which we happen to pass, which kink.com, I believe, is located on the corner of 14th and Mission in the old armory of San Francisco, and now is a kind of a panoply of different various activities.
Interests.
Water bondage.
Extracurricular interests. It totally changes your view of the neighborhood if you have this idea that there are things going on in that building.
Yes.
I think it's very fitting considering what the building looks like.
It's
rather honest.
It represents an internal brutality that the aesthetics of the architecture represent within a visual exterior sense. It's amazing.
It's actually a perfect manifestation of that specific structure.
Mm-hmm. Right. They're finally putting it to good use.
So now you two seem fairly well acquainted. And how is it that you came to know each other?
We came to know one another through artist, New York-based, formerly Portland-based artist named John Vitale, who I happen to edit a journal with. It's called, actually it has no name, it's kind of like a pregnant pause, but for accessibility's sake, it's called Dots and Quotes. And John moved to New York a long time ago now, maybe about 7 years ago, 8 years ago. And through John, I met Adam because Adam wrote an article for the first issue of Dots and Quotes, and just on I was doing work in New York. I think I was doing doing in New York at the time?
Squirrel noises,
when I met you?
Yeah,
can't
remember.
Not sure.
I don't know what.
It might have been Ghost Town.
Oh, yeah, it was just after Ghost Town. And we were doing some work. We did a project in Portland called Ghost Town. And we had gone to New York just after the completion of that project. That project took place in Portland. It was specifically about Portland. And we went to New York and kind of used models that we had established for Ghost Town to talk about aspects of kind of New York social history.
Sounds good. And that
and we met Adam there.
And that dovetailed into, years later, a larger project that stemmed out of one of Red 76's projects, Revolutionary Days, where you guys took a large-scale, or Revolutionary Spirit, sorry, a large road trip across the United States together.
Yeah, Revolutionary Spirit is a project that we're kind of still in the middle of right now, and this road trip that you're talking about is an aspect of it. Revolutionary Spirit as a project is really kind of just a question, and then there are all of these varied initiatives that we've put out into the world that try to kind of draw this question into a public dialogue, and the question being, you know, as we're here as a country, the United States of America, because of the revolutionary thought and action of a number of individuals, some, you know, 230 odd years ago, how do we encounter, how do we define revolution in America today? If that is supposed to be kind of the foundation of this country, and I think it seems that there are kind of two poles within general understanding of America's relationship to revolution. Either, like, if you bring it up, you're kind of some naive kook, or you're talking about some varied form of commercialism, you know, like the iPod revolution, Big Mac revolution.
Denny's revolution,
what have you. But there's nothing, you know, there's this kind of void within the middle. And now if that's the case, you know, I think it's important that we start asking these questions. Because that's the ground floor of our history. So through that, we're just about developing all of these initiatives. And one of them was in December of 2006. I went on a one-month road trip around the country, just kind of hopped in the car and picked up different friends along the way in different sections, investigating revolutionary localities, sites of kind of past social upheaval or conflict or transcendence of some sort.
Historical hotspots, if you will.
Yeah, but also talking about how kind of social histories can go underlooked, that they can kind of get paved over by contemporary life, and that there are these layers of action, layers of history all around us at any time. And that's, you know, neither... There was this idea, some people asked me, like, well, did you, like, were there monuments that you were going to? And I was like, no, these are just places that you would, for all intents and purposes, you would have no idea anything happened here. But I think one thing we don't really pay attention to enough within our everyday existence is that there are a whole myriad of histories that are around us at any point in time. You know, as many people as might have passed by that spot, or even in that matter, chose not to go to that spot, create these varied histories, these nebulous histories. And it was a way to go and kind of just absorb those areas.
Okay. Maybe, Adam, you could tell us a little bit about your experiences on the road as well.
Well, I remember Sam said he was doing this project and said, would you like to come join me? And I said, you know, why not? I mean, in particular, I have a little bit of experience going across the country, but I mean, everyone always critiques America for its insularity when, and basically its lack of global perspective, but simultaneously it's not insular because most people don't really go around the country itself and explore it. So that's something when Sam brought up the opportunity I was particularly invested in because, you know, what are these evil red states, as everyone says, is like, well, maybe we should go and see these so-called evil people and maybe...
Plunder.
Maybe, oh, yes.
Yeah, which is primarily where we were. I mean, it was all of December, starting off at the beginning of the month, going from Portland, Oregon, all the way down the West Coast to L.A., over from L.A. into Nevada and through through Utah and Arizona and the desert and whatnot,
that was
in Mexico,
pretty.
Which was beautiful. And
Two Guns.
And, yeah, Two Guns, Arizona is a very interesting place. I suggest you go.
Two Guns, One Car.
Two Guns, One Car. And up, you know, through Texas and Oklahoma into Kansas and then into the South, and then up through the Midwest and then back through Montana, back to Portland. This was all within a month, I think 7,500 miles within a month. Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, one of the questions that I hear occasionally from younger people, I would say, especially, you know, under 45, something like that, that the idea of revolution is a joke, that there really is no possibility of revolution. And I actually got in an argument with a curator from MoCA LACMA in Philadelphia recently, who said that there was no such thing as revolution. There was only changing regimes. And so as you guys kind of tackle this large-scale investigation of what revolution means in the past, and kind of trying to redefine it for the future. I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, that really bothers me in that I think statements like that negate the idea of citizen action, the power of the citizen, and as if we mean nothing. And that doesn't make me really want to be around. It doesn't fill me with any hope. And I think we've kind of lost any idea of hope in general, and statements like that, I think, really encompass that idea of like, well, you're powerless. It doesn't matter. You're a cog, and whether it's true or not, or whether it's ever been true,
do you think
I just
true?
Don't. No, because look at all the amazing things that have happened throughout the world, whether in the U.S. or elsewhere. When it's been a group of citizens getting together and saying no, and like this is not the way that I want to live. I think it's an intrinsic human ability to fight for your belief in equality, and that doesn't always work out great, but people can band together to do that.
Well, and also too, I mean, when people say revolution now, they have a very
like a Hollywood idea of it,
One is a Hollywood idea, but older is this sort of like 19th century militaristic idea of revolution, where it's sort of a black and white sort of vanguard that then fights
like
off.
Up against the barricades.
Yeah, up against
the
barricades.
Bomb-throwing anarchist.
Right, and you know that's not really what revolution is. That's a kind of revolution. That's a violent military revolution. But there are also subtle reforms, let's say, or other actions that happen day to day, which completely change our field of activity, practice, either psychologically, organizationally, and it might not necessarily be this violent overthrow that a lot of people assume revolution means.
Absolutely, so, and like these are all histories that that can go under-acknowledged, that are happening right now and have happened in the past. And it's a matter of semantics to figure out, do you consider that a revolution or not? Mm-hmm. But I think there are many different forms, and the kind of stock Hollywood idea of what revolution might be is not the end-all be-all of that discussion.
Sounds good. Now, maybe you can highlight for us some of the different kinds of revolution that you guys found out on the road. Tell us some of the gritty details, as it were.
You want to go?
Adam, no, why don't you go first?
I mean, the most particular one I had in my own mindset was when we visited Alabama.
Yeah,
I think.
Which was absolutely fascinating, and how one man's kind of determination to be a chronicler of a time changed our whole belief in a particular system of social interaction and government in the end.
Mm-hmm. I mean, when I went there too, and it's one of these things of how much your own misconceptions can physically almost change your perception of a space. We entered into Birmingham. Of course, we all know the story of Birmingham very well, particularly sort of John Coltrane's minor notes in the song Alabama is kind of the mood I was feeling when we went there. And
perhaps for those listening who aren't familiar, you could share a little bit.
Like those notes?
Those notes.
I can try to sing it if you want.
Go for it, Sam.
That's it.
That's good.
Yeah, thanks. Sorry, I made a mockery of this entire discussion.
No, but it was the same thing I was talking about before, about breaking sort of insular patterns of a sort of like Northeast privilege, thinking of Alabama as a sort of regressive, oppressive, you know, somewhat racist area. And of course, it's confirmed by one of the first places we visit is sort of the front lines of the civil rights movement, where various churches were firebombed on very racist contexts. But then across the street from that, we went to one of the most amazing restaurants.
Yeah, LeVay's Fine Foods.
LeVay's Fine Foods, which kind of, you know, it's like, yes, this history is here, but why should this be the dominant feeling that, you know, makes my sky look grayer, even though I know this, when across the street there's still signs of signs. I mean, there's thriving vitality and culture being produced.
Yeah, and one also, I mean, like, it's very easy to see the change within, you know, the time that... the 16th Street Baptist Church was bombed, wherein we go down the street to LeVay's, which is, you know, primarily, like, black-owned, primarily kind of patronized by the African-American population, amazing soul food place. But we're two white kids that go in, and at the time of that bombing, had we gone in, I think it would have been a much different feeling. But then, you know, like... more than 40 years later, Adam and I get to walk in, and everybody's having a good time, having great conversations. They're happy that we're there, and we're happy that we're there. So there are these small signs of progress. So, like, why is the monument, and it should be, like, this kind of, the visual manifestation, the structural manifestation, obviously, you shouldn't forget that. But I think you should also highlight the fact that, like, hey, we're all eating together now. That's a big deal, and we're having, you know, we're having this convivial moment and saying, and like going up to the people afterwards and saying, this is some of the best food I've ever had. Thank you so much. Mm-hmm. I'm really happy I came here.
And so that, in a sense, would be a sort of revolution, as you would qualify.
Absolutely, but it's very quiet.
Well, and I would just say, you know, personally, psychologically, it's a revolution.
Yeah.
I mean, restructuring your opinion of a space which you have a prejudice on, which you're, you know, in some ways is basically the thing you're critiquing, and then, you know, come out of your world and sit down and slow down for a minute and actually share some food with people, and you'll change your mind.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the other ones that you came... Gems Across the Road.
Well, not to leave Alabama for a second, there was a man that we met there who, by the name of Charles Moore, who is a photographer. He and a few of his friends who have kind of created this cadre of just kind of cultural... awareness within Florence, Alabama, which is about an hour and a half north of Birmingham, were so gracious. I mean, they were the epitome of Southern hospitality.
Mm-hmm.
Invited us into their home, gave us a building to sleep in, you know, just like, here, just stay here. We didn't even know them. We just kind of stopped in. And Charles Moore was a photographer for Life magazine. He's taken pretty much every iconic civil rights era Southern photograph that you've seen. And just by, I mean, he was the man I was mentioning earlier, just by his kind of determination to chronicle this time, I think he was able to change race relations within the city and humanize the plight of blacks in the South in the 60s, but are also kind of like our national relationship between races. He took that photo, I guess the most iconic image for me is the one girl and the two teenage boys kind of pinned up against a storefront doorway as like a water cannon is like spraying all over them, and like the one boy, his like back is arched almost as if it's like this laser going into his spine, and he took that photo and took many of the photos that you probably know of Bull Connor's police, Birmingham police at the time, using dogs to attack protesters in Birmingham, and I think through his chronicling and determination, he did a lot to change race relations in this country.
Okay.
Being able to meet him was remarkable.
Mm-hmm. Sounds good.
And particularly one of the people who I think, introduced us to him, and then we continued to talk to his woman named Natalie Changin,
mm-hmm.
who, very, very interesting because of its history, Alabama, of being the cotton belt, more or less.
Yeah.
It has sort of systematically produced a culture in which people had a relationship to that cotton, either from the harvesting or from the twilling, is that what it's called when you make string? Or whatever, when you
the
make
stringing?
The stringing. And then, of course, the production of garments and textiles. And part of the sort of recession, beyond that, I mean, most of these counties in Alabama are the poorest in the nation, Hale County, for example. And how, you know, this is this history of this material cotton, which we all know as this sort of 19th century, you know, slave-related material that, you know, has a long history of race relations, and that's how it's presented in the common consciousness. But in fact, you know, cotton, we're obviously wearing it right now, and the relation...
All silk, baby.
All silk. Ooh. Well, that's my underwear, but... and people forgetting about that and letting one history, the sort of 19th century history of cotton, really dictate their ideas, which then have a massive effect on now, where this you know, centuries old industry has created
was a vernacular skill set
within
that area that is then underutilized and economically affects the entire region. So there are all these people who have this skill set. Oh, fanfare.
Ooh.
That's awesome.
Skill sets.
Vernacular.
That's the word of the day. Skill sets. there were trumpets if the radio mics didn't pick that up. It was really nice.
Soundproof room.
Yes, so within this area, there are all these people who have these skills that are underutilized, and it affects the economy, and Natalie was able to kind of utilize this... these people to at least somewhat pay mind to her cultural history, her personal history, and
that place,
and that place, invested. And that land,
yeah.
And she was very invested in coming back to where she grew up, and utilizing the skills of the people in the area to create this like haute couture clothing line using the like centuries old Southern. Craft.
All right. So maybe to switch gears a little bit here, as far as ideas of hope, and that's a lot of what, you know, the idea of revolution centers around, and Sam, a little bit about what you discussed before, many people feel that America is kind of in the abyss right now.
Absolutely,
That it would be in the deepest trough, possibly, that Americans have been in since the inception of this country. Adam, what are your feelings on hope in America today? Is it plausible? Is it possible? Is it even desirable?
Well, I mean, to unpack that a little bit, I particularly dislike when people think that their position is privileged and unique, and in so doing to then give it absolute value, like to pretend like they're in an end game or terrible situation. I would not say America's in the worst place it's been in. I would say it's been in this place many times. And looking at that and remembering that history and seeing how various struggles overthrew other regimes, which are now coming back again, I wouldn't even look to hope. I'd look to history. I'd look to action. I'd look to proven results. And I would be a lot more pragmatic and, let's say, indebted as opposed to wishing for something.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like utilizing history as a tool rather than just something that can... make you feel like, oh, it was so much better back then. Look what they were able to do. Like, well, they were looking towards a particular time period as well for inspiration, and they were able to utilize that. I mean, you have Martin Luther King looking towards Gandhi.
Yeah.
So just for one, you know, finite example. Yeah, so though I do feel this overwhelming apathy, but it does bother me, and hence why a lot of the work that I'm interested in doing is kind of providing ideas of possibilities and providing ideas of hope, and that it may seem like one person saying one thing can't really do anything, but if you set up the idea that like the accumulated voice of the American populace time and time again has shown that it can do something grand and positive and pragmatic for the whole of the nation, no matter what your political viewpoints might be. I mean, it's made it a better place. Then you, I think it's your duty as a citizen to go out there and say, hey, we, the collective we, can do something, and that it does have to be the collective we. It has nothing to do with what your political stance might be. It has to do with, just everyday justice for the for the everyday citizen.
Mm-hmm. One thing that I think, you know, and I might be wrong, so, you know, feel free to jump on me, because, I'm sure you will, never mind. But is
only
that,
in a good way.
Yes. And that'll be saved for later.
King.com.
Yeah.
The television.
The television.
The big bad boogeyman.
The Cosby television.
And how that affects notions of hope in America. Discuss.
Ooh, that's a big question.
I don't think it's just television, though. I think we moved...
I'm specifically asking about TV.
But, I don't think there is a thing called television anymore. I think there's just a thing called media.
Media,
and
okay.
What we saw as the power of television through its heyday, I think has become all forms of media, whether that be, you know, YouTube or... print media or the television or podcasting, it doesn't really matter. Anything on the internet, it's just all media now. Mm-hmm. And it's... what is interesting for me is that it's so widely dispersed and unregulated at this point, where no one really has a controlling faction to be able to kind of mediate our society. So I think that's one of the reasons why we're kind of in this like real cloudy area as towards what an individual or groups of individuals can do, because we don't know how to like really get the message out. Though, you know, there are ways that like we can see the tools. We don't quite see what we can build with it. But that's quickly changing, and there are a lot of instances that happens. Like one of the places that I first visited on this trip was the Powell Library at UCLA, where a student was who didn't have his student ID and wanted to get some work done in the computer lab was told to leave, and he said, "No, I want to finish my work." And the campus police were called, and he was fine. They're like, "Fine, I'll go." And they're like, "No, we're arresting you." And they wound up tasering him. Oh, God, I think, like, something like 7 times in 7 minutes, and saying, like, "Stand up, we're going to taser you again." But he's basically incapacitated at this point, moaning on the ground as 30 people surround him, and they taser him again, just because he didn't have a student ID, and he wanted to get some work done. But there's some fellow student in the library who has his camera phone and takes a 7-minute video that is then sent all around the world, and that becomes like the kind of like citizen watchdog, citizen police, that the more mainstream media of the past, kind of the very journalism of the past used to be, we all get to be our own, like our own journalists at this point. Now,
the Rodney King phenomenon.
Yeah, and what would have happened were the Rodney King tape taped today, and didn't have to rely on like the ABC affiliate in LA to be able to air it. I mean, there's like one person within an editorial newsroom who has to deem whether it's news. Now, this is not to say that this is better or worse, but I think it leads us to a really interesting point within this period of American history. And I don't quite know where that's going to go, but I think with that in mind, it's important to get out in public and start asking these questions of what can we do to make our lives more pragmatic, more just create a state of equity,
Adam?
Between us.
I think it's an interesting question, because if you look at the history of communications outside of TV, which everyone always likes to look at, every time a new technology has been produced, dating back at least to the printing press, there's always been rhetoric surrounding it as this sort of new revelatory device which will become democratic through its mass dissemination and thus bring forth a great utopia. That's happened with the book, as I first said, the magazine and the newspaper in the 19th century, followed by the radio, the telephone, then
The LP record,
followed by TV, and then ultimately by the internet now. And in fact, people should be looking at the internet now because, yes, all technologies and all forms of communication do hold these possibilities, but in fact, there's regulatory controls which hem them in, which are not just endemic to technology, but even to space and sort of freedoms as to what's public space, what's private space, and the like. And a lot of the attention, although a lot of people like to take a sort of, for lack of a better word, like Marshall McLuhan, like how does the device affect me in viewing it, that's really superficial. A lot of things that people should be looking at is how is that technology then hemmed in by certain acts of litigation and restructuring that argument towards that litigation that has been around since time immemorial. And those are really the processes which mediate you.
So but I think with that in mind, to get back on kind of this idea of hope, one should look at contemporary technology less on how does the media affect me, but in what way through my everyday actions can I then go and affect the media? And by kind of vocally responding to new forms of mediated technology, we get to affect development because it's all about capital. So like, as long as the consumers go and say we want this for these reasons, there is either going to be like philanthropic capital or just, you know, plain money grubbing capital thrown into the pool to make what we want.
Now tell me, maybe you guys can explain, but tell me your experience with this kind of phenomenon and how you've reacted to it. Many times I've heard people say that, you know, that there's a kind of stigma around activism now, that it's that they look down on it a little bit as something that was, you know, valuable definitely in the 60s for the civil rights movement, but that is really, it's kind of past its heyday, in that those things are kind of yesteryear, and that now it's a little bit distasteful to be an activist. Have you experienced attitudes like that?
I guess. I think that's really hopeless, very, like...
How do you deal with that?
Apathetic feeling. Well, I mean, for one thing, I don't think I'm an activist, only because I think activism traditionally has to have quantifiable goals and end goals. And that's not what I do. Hence, this kind of amalgamation of varying frameworks.
Agitator?
Agitator might be a little bit better. but these like varying frameworks that tend to enter my practice, and with an activist slant being one of those things, I think that's why it turns into art, because it's a little bit unqualifiable, and art allows you to experiment with form. And I just have a lot of political interests, and so that's kind of how it enters into that. So I wouldn't necessarily call myself an activist, but the idea of, I do think there's a stigma around that, which I think is absolutely absurd. Why would anyone think there's anything bad in caring about how your country works and how individuals are treated and having a more just social environment in this country, a more just political system? There's nothing wrong with that. But I think there's still a fallout. I think that's just a fallout from the 60s. We see like all this idealism and then a bunch of crap. So it's hard not to think like, oh, it doesn't mean anything. But that's also bullshit. I think if you... Oh, am I not allowed to...
Bullshit. Merde de vache.
I guess I said something.
Well, we're on the real radio, so yes.
Are we?
The FCC, speaking of registrations that will hem you in, the FCC is definitely a large institution that is directly responsible for, you know, dictating, I would say, or controlling certain aspects of how we communicate today. Mm-hmm.
Can you beat me out?
I can try to beep you out.
Well, it's easy enough, isn't it?
It depends how many times you're going to say it. Now, anyway, continue.
Well, I won't say it again. Mm.
Well, I think that the hilarious thing, too, since we're on the FCC really quick, that you can't say words like bullshit, but because the government deems that bad in a sort of Protestant moral ethic, yet they don't control any sort of regulation of other, even things called moral hazard in banking, which is where you spread your responsibility through various debt and credit spending, and that most of this country has this mantra in economics of free market libertarianism, but when it comes to communication, ooh, what's this?
It's more fanfare. They like what we're talking about.
Yes. But when it comes
free market capitalism.
When it comes to anything that trespasses sort of ideas of religious mores, that's when our government actually seems to act, which I think is really unfortunate. And a lot of sort of social discourse is focused on a very limited sense of obscenity.
I agree.
Preach, baby.
Woo!
So, now let's switch gears altogether.
Okay.
Love.
What about it?
Robert Indiana.
I love you. I'm sorry that I cursed.
No, that's not what we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about love and how it affects both of your practices. Do you think that both of you have been in love at one time?
With one another?
Been. Wow, sure. Past tense?
Now don't get semantic on me. Have you been in love with somebody at one point in your life?
I'm in love with somebody right now.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you've been in love with somebody.
A couple of different people.
At one point in your life as well, and both making work before and after and during those periods, right?
Oh, yeah, of course.
Sure.
Tell me how your work is affected by this kind of amorphous mass of, you know, all-fingered love.
I don't think it's affected by a particular individual. I think it's protected. I think it deals with just the idea in general. I love this, like...
I know.
No, I kind of like it. Yeah,
nice. Yeah. Gives it really kind of a psycho feel to it, doesn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah, it's good.
Love.
Steam over a dark alleyway. Love. A woman in a clear trench coat. What?
You don't like Blade Runner?
Are they going to bleep that out?
Anyway, love, you.
Yeah, just kind of an overarching idea of what love might be. And I think love... I don't know. Love and hope can be kind of interchangeable in that sense, and that it's just something that you're striving for. You're striving for a certain sense of contentedness, both intellectually and spiritually. That you're, you know, creating these forms of possibilities, because no matter how hopeless they may seem or how ridiculously utopian, you still strive for it, and that can be a better, you know, this idea of a better world is possible, or it can be interchangeable with I might actually be contented with this, with one, you know, with someone, or maybe a group of people, depending on what you're interested in, but that you can, you know, there is that something out there that, like, there are good things around the corner.
Adam, yourself, love?
Well, I mean, in relation to practice, which I think is the question you're raising, I'd like to say actually ambivalence is really a more powerful motivator, because at the same time there's all these things that we're going up against, and at the same time they're products of our culture, and in some degree to understand them you also have to love them, much as you get mediated by them. And I think having that ability to both, be tempted by the dark side and able to go over to it is really important. And I think, a healthy sense, because the world's complicated and everything is wrought with contradictions. So, I think ambivalence is a very useful structure for working.
And in your own personal practice, though, have you found the effects of being in love to be beneficial, be not so beneficial?
Well, if I'm in love, I'm probably not going to do any work.
Yeah. And so you would actually argue that, you know, love is a detriment to your practice.
No. I wouldn't necessarily equate the two in such a fashion. Sometimes, most anthropologists believe most artistic practice came out as a secondary thing for people who aren't physically strong enough to attract other mates. So, just like...
I play basketball once a week. I go to the gym. I'm extremely strong.
My
biceps are huge now because I'm carrying around my new child.
Muscle milk.
Yeah.
But, you know, let's take a clue from the bird of paradise who gets his blue feathers to attract his mates. And, you know, I won't deny maybe, you know, to some aspect... you know, your practice and the fact that you put things out in the world is to attract people.
And?
Yeah, I can see that in a way.
I'm not necessarily saying romantically either, but...
Maybe not romantically, but you at least want to feel like you have something to give, like you're a positive contributor to your society. I mean, I think that aspect has a lot to do with my practice. I want to... And that really, in the end, gets to be more of an internal thing, more of, like you were bringing up with Coulter and Leslie, kind of a spiritual thing, where I feel like it's my obligation to give back to my world, for me to feel whole, for me to feel like I need to create a sense of mindfulness around me, for me to feel spiritually contented, or else.
How does that relate to, I mean, the marketplace? When you look at artists today, you know, many people consider, for the most part, art to be the realm of museums, the art to be the realm of your Van Goghs, your Picassos, and maybe if you're fairly contemporary, you know, your Matthew Barneys, something to be put on the wall or a sculpture form, and that's pretty much the end of it. It's to be paid $11 at the MoMA, and and that's the extent of where art ends. Now, both of your guys' practice extends beyond that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think my practice runs parallel to that in a way. It would be disingenuous for me to say that money doesn't enter into it because I have to survive, but I do think it's... I don't think it relates to the contemporary art market whatsoever, and there's been a long history of a lot of work along these lines that... You know, just that doesn't enter into it. It just depends on your definition of what those artistic practices are. Mm-hmm.
What do you think about the other side? I mean, is there fulfillment, contentment to be had in the selling of objects?
I'm sure there is, but I don't know. I mean, that's probably one of the reasons why I'm not there. Because I don't know, I can't find contentment in the idea of I make something, I sell something. Mm-hmm. I'd rather just kind of live my life and hopefully get compensated for my ideas and my actions. If I could figure out how to sell something, I'd do it. But I can't.
Hotcakes.
Yeah.
Adam, yourself?
Well, you know, there's a lot of talk about the market and whatever, and I don't really feel like going into that right now. One of the things I'd like to go into, though, is this really limited idea of the museum. Yes, it has its problems, and it's very deterministic, but if you consider it as such, you're really not paying attention to the viewer as an individual or as a human.
Or as intelligent.
Or as intelligent,
I think there's this top-down idea of, like, we tell you, where, rather than it being a symbiotic relationship, much like we were talking about with, like, contemporary technology and the individual and capital, that like your interaction and your voice within that creates the environment. And I think I have a very different view of museums maybe than what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. I see them as educational structures. And for the people, and maybe that's just where I grew up. I mean, I got to grow up going to the Met and you know, the Frick and the Museum of Modern Art and the Whitney. Mm-hmm. And at the time, they weren't like, well, the Met was free and the other museums were pretty... Yeah, it still is. But and the other museums were, you know, really not that expensive to get into. And I think there was this idea of it's community resource. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's a little less so now just because of how much it takes to get into, like, MoMA's $20.
Yeah, that's
ridiculous.
A big deal, yeah.
But I see those places as places to learn because that was how I interacted with them growing up.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah. I mean, and it's a very, very long discussion. I mean, a place like the MoMA, which has a 100-year legacy, which has some of the most, well, art historically important works, and on top of it has a board run by some of the most powerful people in the world. But, I mean, beyond that, like what Sam was saying with the Met, it's still a quarter if you want to pay that much,
yeah,
which is really important. And
absolutely.
You know, maybe there's a Pissarro show. Who cares? Maybe I just want to have a sandwich and sit by the reflecting pool and look at the ancient Egyptian statues. And
what I think is that I really like is it's important to them, too.
Yeah.
I can't remember the name of the director who had been there for so long.
Montebello?
Yeah. I mean, like, there was a point in the mid-70s or something where they were... aspects of the board were hoping to have people pay, and he fought to make it pay what you want, no matter what, because he saw it as a public institution, and you shouldn't have to pay to get in here if you either don't want to or can't afford to that day, that it's like a library.
Mm-hmm.
And it should be like a library.
Mm-hmm.
We also have less libraries now, I think, which is also a shame.
Which is also, yeah.
But we have an internet, so, I mean, many people would argue that picks up the slack.
Yeah, I don't think that's true.
Mm.
Well, gentlemen, I think that's about all the time we have.
Should we close out with another musical interlude?
I wouldn't mind.
Solo? Maybe can you do a solo?
Oh, I don't know. Such pressure.
Give me a beat. Come on.
Can we have a cowboy song? I'll be the horse.
You're listening to Frank Prattle. This is Zephyr Thrall. You're listening at 89.5 KPOO here in San Francisco. Or you're listening to WPS1, Art Radio, PS1 Contemporary Art Center, www.wps1.org. You might also be listening at San Francisco Arts Commission Gallery at www.sfacgallery.org, and of course at frankprattle.com. Today my special guests have been Adam Kleinman, an associate curator at the Lower Manhattan Cultural Council, and Sam Gould, an agitator and known artist of red76.com. Thank you both so much.
Thanks, everybody. I had a great time.
Thank you, too.
Sorry, I cursed.
Me, too.